This is Tax Update for Saturday, January the 28th, 2006. This tax update is the sad story of the superintendent and Section 62. Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those who are not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and the supporting documents may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document. Such prohibited use would include using the podcast or document as part of a CPE presentation for which a fee is charged. This podcast is sponsored by Limeburg Information Services, found on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. Limeburg Services provides email newsletters of interest to tax professionals to its subscribers. Go to the website at www.limeburgservices.com for information on subscribing to their services. I've often told clients that the Congress of the United States does not like employees. And while I'm sure my congressman and my two senators would disagree with that way of looking at the law, reality is the people who are employed have a disadvantage when we look at business expenses. And this disadvantage shows up in numerous areas. Last year, we discovered from the Supreme Court that generally, employment-related legal fees were not going to be able to be offset against legal income. What was the problem there? Well, the problem there is really more general as to how we do that and why those deductions had to go below the line and cause large alternative minimum tax problems for those employees who had the legal awards. And the issue goes to the basic fact that the law treats employees differently. This week we're going to study a case, the case of Alley versus Commissioner, which was a tax court summary opinion 2006-4, where an employee discovered the hard way about their expenses were less equal, shall we say, than those incurred in some other manner than as an employee, if your trade or business is anything else than as an employee. We're going to look at it this week and discover, first, why that's true, and secondly, deal with the exact facts of the Alley case and maybe some ideas and some planning ideas we are going to get from looking at the results there and then dealing with our clients and trying to help our clients either avoid the Alley result or at least reduce its impact. Now, I should note the Alley opinion obviously is a summary opinion. It's not precedent. But it's still rather useful to look at to see an analysis of a real set of facts, an analysis of those set of facts compared to the law in front of the court where the case went all the way forward. I also always find it interesting to look at these types of cases because many times questions come up and I'll be asked whether something is practical. That is, are we just talking about a theoretical issue here? Well, reality is, whenever we look at a court case, we're not looking at theoretical, we're looking at a case that actually got pushed all the way through. Therefore, there was an exam, the issue was raised, and the issue was actually taken all the way through to the court, so we can assume it was serious. So I've always found cases to be useful, even if, like as will be true of this case, it doesn't have any direct precedential value, it's still very useful as an analysis. And frankly, very useful as a guide as to how to analyze the case and how to analyze the fact patterns if you have a fact pattern that is very similar to what you find in one of these cases. Let's talk about business deductions generally under the Internal Revenue Code. In general, business deductions are governed by Section 162 of the Internal Revenue Code. And that basically is this section that we're all aware of, the ordinary and necessary business expenses paid or incurred during the taxable year and carrying on any trade or business. Note, any trade or business includes trade or business incurred as an employee. That is a trade or business under the Internal Revenue Code. In fact, for probably most of the population, that is their main trade or business is as an employee. So if you incur expenses as an employee, the Internal Revenue Code in Code Section 162 tells me that generally I get to deduct. Now, we're all aware there are limitations on that deduction. There are some issues regarding that deduction that we can have some things we don't get or things that we get in a restricted manner like entertainment. But nevertheless, we are still allowed generally the very broad, ordinary, and necessary category. A key issue, though, that arises instantly and where we're going to run into our problem is where do we get this deduction? Now, when you prepare an individual tax return, you know that deductions end up one of two places, and we normally refer to it as above the line or below the line. And for those of you who may not be in on the terminology here, and most likely almost everybody who is listening to this podcast is in on this part of the terminology, but the line we are talking about is the line that computes adjusted gross income, which is the last line you find on the front page of the Form 1040. And the theory being that those items that go into computing adjusted gross income are above the line, with AGI being the line. And those items that are used later and used to compute taxable income are below the line. Adjusted gross income is a very, very important concept for many aspects of the Internal Revenue Code. There are a lot of things that are governed by your AGI level. Therefore, it does become very important to know, is a deduction above the line or is it below the line? Well, if you look at Code Section 162 in isolation, you're not going to find any evidence of which side of the line the Code 162 deduction would go on for an individual. In fact, you check most deductions, there will never be a mention as to whether the deduction that is being allowed by this section is an above-the-line or a below-the-line deduction. That is governed in a separate code section at the very start of the Internal Revenue Code. Very early code sections we find will tell us this definition. And what we discover here is that the key section we need to look at is Code Section 62. Code Section 62 tells us how to compute adjusted gross income. And what Code Section 62 tells us is, essentially, here are the list of items you can use to reduce your gross income in computing adjusted gross income. This is an important structure to understand at this point. The default for every deduction you find in the Internal Revenue Code is that that deduction is a below-the-line deduction. You get it above the line only if it is in the list found in Code Section 62. It falls into one of the categories that Code Section 62 will allow to be deducted above the line. So we find our key definition. Now, this structure, for those of you who haven't looked at the code in detail or don't do a lot of code work, you need to understand this part of the structure because it's very normal, not just in the Internal Revenue Code, but in tax law in general, that we quite often have an expansive definition that covers everything, and then we throw things out. So we have an expansive definition that says all items shall be X, and then a specific list of things will be treated as not X. Effectively, in Code Section 62, while we don't quite word it that way, we get to the same result. Essentially, implicit in the wording of Code Section 62 is that all deductions shall be below the line, except these enumerated ones. So now we look for our deduction to fall into the enumerated categories. The key one for this week's analysis is going to be Code Section 62A1. 62A1 provides, in general, the deductions allowed by this chapter, other than by Part 7 of this subchapter, which are attributable to a trade or business carried on by the taxpayer, are deductible in computing adjusted gross income. Except there's a clause right behind the clause that tells us we get it, that tells us that we get this if such trade or business does not consist of the performance of services by the taxpayer as an employee. Side note, if you ever have to prove to somebody, and from time to time we all get stuck with this concept, somebody is insisting on an issue such as what an employee does is not a trade or business, anyone ever calls you on that one, send them back to 62A1 and note that it's implicit in A1 that an employee would be a trade or business. Nice little side thing to have sometime. You just want to slow up a ridiculous argument from time to time, something we all end up unfortunately having to do. But back to our concept. This trader business does not consist. So, remember our default. If it's not in here, if it's not in this list, not in the list of things we can take for AGI, then we can't. Therefore, since it just got removed from the list of things we can take for AGI, trade or business expenses of an employee are not deductible in coming to AGI. It does not mean they're not deductible. It just means they're going to go below the line. What's the hitch with below the line? Well, there really are some major hitches when we move deductions below the line that cause us some problems. First, a number of tax benefits are tied to the level of adjusted gross income. For instance, a taxpayer may simply become unable to make a Roth IRA contribution now that we have this $10,000 of expense that would have put them below the limit for allowing a full contribution to a Roth IRA. We take that below the line, their AGI moves up by that 10 grand, now they're above the limit. Educational expense deductions, keyed similarly. The education credits are tied to AGI, your ability to get one of those. We have the deduction for losses from active rental real estate is tied to AGI. As we move stuff down into itemized deductions, AGI rises. As AGI rises, we may lose those benefits. A number of items phase out of the tax code based upon AGI, such as dependency exemptions. So there's a whole bunch of things we have to worry about here that make moving below the line could cause us to lose a number of tax benefits. Second, some itemized deductions are limited based upon having to exceed a certain percentage of adjusted gross income. For instance, medical expenses are only deductible to the extent the medical expenses exceed 7.5% of a taxpayer's adjusted gross income. If I take that $10,000 deduction and again move it, if the taxpayer would have gone over the top or has excess medical deductions, by moving that $10,000 below the line, I just lost $750 of the taxpayer's medical deductions. Same thing is true for some of the other issues that are limited. We have casualty losses limited to 10% AGI clearance. Again, an issue we're going to lose as we move it below the line. Third, taxpayers are automatically granted a standard deduction by Code Section 63C. So, unless a taxpayer has enough other itemized deductions to clear the limitations for the standard deduction, we find that we're going to move that 10 grand. We may have to use 3 to 4,000, let's say, of that 10 grand just to get ourselves up to the level of the standard deduction. Well, that's 3 to 4,000. We would have gotten a standard deduction anyway, so effectively we get no benefit from having to itemize. Or if we have very little in the way of other itemized deductions, let's say a taxpayer whose home is totally paid off, has not gone back out and done a lot of home equity borrowing, basically has very little, lives in a no income tax state, doesn't have a lot of real estate taxes sitting there, doesn't make huge charitable contributions, suddenly we're sitting here looking at somebody who basically ends up with having very, very little that they can make use of, and they may find they get almost no benefit from the deduction if it comes out under that mechanism. So we take a look and we work on these areas, and it makes for a very big problem. Fourth, itemized deductions are further limited with income above certain levels. There are AGI, there are taxpayers whose income phases out at various levels. Code Section 68 takes that away. Note, this is one of those provisions that is scheduled to start phasing out of the law this year, and in 2009, in 2010 would disappear, and then like the estate tax, it all comes back in 2011. That's a whole story for another day about what will happen there, and it's a story nobody has the answer to yet. But realize, we are going to see a decrease in here, and it's a nice thing to sit off to the side and remember. But we're not going to see this fully go away until 2010, unless Congress acts to do something. It goes away just for 1 year, then comes back. So, for now, we still have to worry about the fact we're going to lose some of the itemized deductions if our income goes above a certain level. Well, those are all bad enough, but for an employee, we're going to take it one worse. And that is, itemized deductions are disadvantaged in general, but certain itemized deductions are more disadvantaged than others. And probably the most disadvantaged itemized deduction we can find, aside from casualty losses, which you have to clear 10% of AGI and normally means you won't get a deduction. But miscellaneous itemized deductions face a couple of big problems. First, miscellaneous itemized deductions are only deductible to the extent they, as a whole, we take them all together, they exceed 2% of adjusted gross income per Section 67A. And unlike other itemized deductions that are limited by AGI, these are not protected from the Section 68 phase-out. So we can lose them even after getting the 2% haircut. We can still lose them again. And in fact, by having to move them below the line, we raise our AGI, increases the phase out, increases the 2%, and then increases the phase out. So we're losing them even faster if they're miscellaneous. But second, and probably the more important issue today, miscellaneous itemized deductions are not deductible in computing the alternative minimum tax. See Section 56B1 Cap A little I. The alternative minimum tax is becoming a much bigger problem in recent years because, as most of you are aware, it generally was not indexed for inflation. More and more taxpayers are becoming subject to the AMT each year, and a much larger number sits just under triggering it. So that if these taxpayers incur a large miscellaneous itemized deduction, they will probably lose much of their benefit of that itemized deduction due to the alternative minimum tax. The alternative minimum tax is effectively, and I say this in quotes because we know we have cases where the tax court has told us this isn't how it works, and my only answer is, but it is really for all practical purposes. The alternative minimum tax is a second tax system. Therefore, what it tells you is the number with, if you have disadvantaged items that are generating or reducing your tax, your calculation of the alternative minimum taxable income and then the base tax that you're going to use on the alternative minimum tax system tells us how low we can take our taxes before we're going to lose any benefit. For many taxpayers, there is a narrow and rapidly narrowing range for which they could still get a benefit from having a miscellaneous itemized deduction. If Congress does not act to extend some of the relief that expired at December 31st of 2005, a much larger number in 2006 will face this problem. That also is a good warning for those of you running tax projection software. Those of you who have projection software like BNA's Tax Planner, realize that software generally these days is presuming Congress will do nothing. So when you project 2006, realize that your software is making a worst case presumption and that realistically Congress will probably fix it. So be very, very careful of making decisions based on what you see from these software of 2006 numbers. The 2006 numbers may change once Congress actually passes the reconciliation bill and deals with the AMT fix as well, whether in the reconciliation bill or whether separately. Well, to raise an interesting question, what makes something a miscellaneous itemized deduction? Well, you're going to find that in Section 67B, we see Congress once again using the technique we discussed. Throw everything in the pot and then tell us specifically what comes out of the pot. Section 67B tells us initially all itemized deductions are miscellaneous itemized deductions and then says other than, and then it lists the specific items, and you're going to find your interest, your taxes, your charitable contributions, your medical. What you won't find generally are employee business expenses, trade or business expenses incurred by a person in employment. Because those are not listed on our list of items that count as not miscellaneous itemized deductions, by definition, they are miscellaneous itemized deductions. That subjects them to the 2% phase out and means that for alternative minimum tax purposes, these taxes are not, these, or I should say, these expenses are not deductible. Okay, well, what can we do? Well, first, I'll refer you back. Back in July, I did an earlier podcast on one potential solution for this problem where we talked about the accountable plan under Section 62C. I'm not going to repeat that information here, but simply refer you back to that older podcast. The link to that podcast is in my materials for this podcast, so you can go ahead, take your link there, and go back over the 62C position. But that is one potential fix if you're in a position to make that happen. Now let's talk about a specific taxpayer's other attempted solution. Mr. Alley gets points for creativity here, even if he doesn't get much points for having anything that would work. Mr. Alley was a field superintendent responsible for on-site management. So he had to go on to the various job sites for his employer and supervise the work at the sites, then go to the next site. He traveled around in his own pickup truck that he provided. His employer had no written reimbursement policy. However, effectively, the employer had a verbal and informal policy for all employees of reimbursing or giving them, and I shouldn't say reimbursing because this was not a reimbursable plan, does not appear under 62C, but rather giving the employees $25 a day for each day they used their personal vehicle for business. That was the basis Mr. Alley saw. Mr. Alley fought this through. And he decided that, well, let's see, I'm being paid $25 today for the use of my personal truck. I think that's a lease. And so I think I'm in the business of leasing my truck to my employer. Now, if that is in fact a separate trade or business, we wonderfully get around the Section 62A1 problem because now we're no longer incurring these expenses as an employee, but rather we are incurring these expenses as part of our rental business. Therefore, Mr. Alley deducted his truck expenses above the line. Now, an interesting aside to this is the IRS and Mr. Alley agreed prior to trial on the amount of those expenses, which were around $25,000 for the 2 years involved. Now, that's interesting because usually we have a big issue on these cases over did the taxpayer comply with the record-keeping requirements of Section 274D. So it would suggest that either Mr. Alley had all of the necessary documentation under 274D, or at least enough to make the IRS happy, or that the IRS chose not to pursue it. Now, the second option doesn't seem likely because we've seen a number of cases where the IRS clearly has pursued the cars, and generally the discussion when I talk to other professionals is that the IRS will pursue that issue. So it would appear that Mr. Alley had good records. Nevertheless, he still had a little bit of a problem with how he was approaching this case, at least according to the tax court. The tax court didn't accept Mr. Alley's view that he was in the trade or business of leasing his vehicle to his employer. The tax court said to analyze this, they're going to look at two criteria. First, did he actually lease the vehicle to his employer? And if he did he have a profit motive in doing so? Now, the court cited for the profit motive a 1976 case explaining why we look at the profit motive for income-producing property, that we look at this to see if we have a reasonable expectation we're going to make a profit from the transaction in question. Now, the court then analyzed Mr. Alley's actions. Mr. Alley had, first, a significant problem before we got started. As we told you, that $25 was offered essentially to every employee and was given to them whenever they used their personal vehicle for company business for that day. Mr. Alley did not offer to lease vehicles to anyone else. Mr. Alley did not really negotiate this $25. He merely accepted what the company gave anybody. And the company certainly never signed a written lease document with Mr. Alley saying they were leasing a vehicle from him. All the company did was gave him a $25 check anytime he told them that he had used the vehicle for company purposes. Therefore, he had a problem with that regard. And the tax court noted that he did not try to lease his truck to any other individuals, and he did not have a written lease, didn't do any negotiations. It would be received by any employee. The tax court had some problems believing that, in fact, he had had an actual lease with his employer. The court also had some problem believing he had a profit motive in doing so, because, again, it seemed like it was more closely related to his motive as an employee, and that as an employee, he might have had a profit motive for employment. But, you know, if it was employment that was driving this, and this is employment-related, then, the tax court notes, we have employee business expense. The tax court did conclude that Mr. Alley had deductions available to him, and he could take deductions for employee business expenses for these amounts that he had paid and incurred as auto expense. But the tax court did not agree that he got them above the line. Planning points. Well, there's a few things I think we need to look at here and apply in real world moving forward. First, this case again shows that merely labeling something a way you'd like it labeled won't help you, especially when all the formalities which you had a chance to control, or at least arguably should have controlled, fail to show this. This is a case very similar to the earlier case we discussed where the taxpayers were attempting to assign income to an S corporation from a real estate brokerage or real estate agents from their brokerage where the broker didn't issue the contract to the S corp. Again, this was a case where the employer never entered into a lease arrangement with anybody and nor are we sure they ever would have cared to do such a thing. The fact that we failed to get the other party to agree they were leasing hurts us. While it probably would not have made Mr. Alley's case had he had a written lease with his employer, the lack of the written lease certainly appears to have been fatal regardless of almost everything else in this case. Mr. Alley at least needs to get the formalities in place. Taxpayers have an extremely uphill fight if the formalities aren't there. You need to be very, very careful of just telling your client, don't worry, we'll just pretend this is something when the formalities don't say that. It is a very difficult fight for the taxpayer to win. Not impossible, but difficult when you have a case like that. Second planning point, go back to the accountable plans. If you are in a position where you can get an accountable plan in place, that is clearly the method to use. If you have a taxpayer who is in control of the employer, that's pretty easy. And in fact, you should do it. We'll discuss that in more detail here shortly. But you may find if your taxpayer is not in control, your taxpayer may be in a position where they can negotiate their compensation. If they can negotiate the compensation, then you should consider having the taxpayer ask the employer to reimburse the expenses using a reimbursable plan. The taxpayer expects and pretty much knows he's going to incur the expenses, so he agrees to take an expense account of X as part of his overall compensation package. The employer factors that into the pay for the taxpayer, and we end up with our package structured. So it'd be better for the taxpayer to take a lower salary with a higher reimbursement amount than take the higher salary and have to get the expenses and then have to move them down below the line. Now, be careful when you do this that you don't run afoul of making this look like a 125 plan, because this is not a use-it-or-lose-it cafeteria-style benefit. While there are some rulings that may suggest we can structure things in some cases under this, if it wasn't used, it's added to income, I don't think I'd go too far down that road, and certainly you don't want to give the impression that a taxpayer can basically elect to take this as cash or either take the benefit as cash or he can take it as reimbursement that is kind of a deferral mechanism or a 125 style mechanism being run here to get the expense above the line. It is much, much cleaner if the taxpayer has agreed and the employer has agreed that the employer will provide an expense reimbursements up to X, and the taxpayer then submits the documentation and uses that. That will make it a much more solid arrangement. Finally, I find many clients who have their own businesses and are in total control of their own corporation still want to take employee business expenses. You need to explain to such taxpayers, and in many cases it's tough because the taxpayer's mindset is that being able to take an employee business expense is a tax break. Well, if you're an employee, you have no control over the employer, then yeah, that's what you do because there's nothing else left to do. But when you have 100% benefit, when you have 100% control of the employer, I always tell the taxpayer that it's much, much better if your employer would pay the whole thing, and you're in a position to make sure your employer is very generous on this regard. I would make sure the employer pays it. Secondly, when you have full control of the employer, if you pay it, you're going to get into a question as to whether that was the company's expense or your expense, you know. And here's your hitch with that. If it's the company's expense that you paid, nobody may get a deduction because you can't get a deduction because it wasn't your expense. And there's a whole bunch of case law there that talks about you pay an expense on behalf of the company. Tough luck. And the company won't get a deduction because it didn't pay the expense. Make sure your taxpayers who have their own closely held companies that are a corporate entity understand and have the company pay the expenses. Employee business expenses, I try to tell all of my clients, are a really, really bad thing. We use them only if we have no other option, and we try to avoid them if possible because it is likely they will get very little or no benefit from those expenses. This has been Tax Update for Saturday, January 28th, 2006. Tax Update is brought to you by Lineberg Information Services, found on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Tax Update is intended for those individuals who do their own independent research to confirm the items raised in this podcast. Please be sure to do so before acting on any of the items discussed here. This has been Tax Update.